Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. A performance by the Lexington Chamber Orchestra of the first movement of Tchaikovsky's Serenade for Strings. This was April 2019. That was then, this is now. Something interesting is happening with music in Lexington. The Chamber Music Festival of Lexington is working to revive the Lexington Chamber Orchestra and bring the orchestra under its umbrella. Many of these musicians now perform with the Lexington Philharmonic. And we're joined on the line from Danville by Chamber Music Festival's new director, Casey Nardalillo, an opera singer, musician in her own right, and she is married to UK music director and conductor John Nardalillo. And with us here in the studio is Marcello Cormio. Marcello heads the Central Kentucky Youth Orchestra and has been named conductor of the newly formed Lexington Chamber Orchestra. Welcome, Casey and Marcello.
Thank you. It's so wonderful to be here with you today.
And so a question for both of you. What is chamber music? Why is it called that? What's unique about it? You want to start, Casey?
Sure. Well, chamber music is generally a group of musicians that play together in smaller ensembles. For instance, rather than a large string orchestra where there are anywhere from 10 to 20 to 50 musicians performing at once, chamber music would be a smaller group of a string quartet, so four players, or a piano trio, which would be three players. It's a more intimate setting where the musicians are making very personal musical choices together and performing for an audience, generally in a smaller venue.
In orchestral playing, a big orchestra, sections of musicians working together to blend their sound and to experience the interplay of voices across the orchestra, but the conductor is at the top of that hierarchy, necessarily, because it's a big mass of people, guiding the musical decisions that are going on. I mentioned before, Marcello, that you're the conductor of the Lexington Chamber Orchestra. Is that correct? Is chamber music conducted?
That's a great question. And to jump back to what Casey was telling us about chamber music, one of the most apparent visual aspect of it for somebody who is not an experienced musician or listener is the fact that this small group of players wouldn't be led by a conductor. That's an element that usually distinguishes what is chamber music in a small ensemble from a full-size symphony orchestra. The conductor, as Tom was saying, is needed because somebody has to lead and to make decisions when we are in a bigger setting. And what is interesting is that yes, there is interplay between the musicians, even in a symphony orchestra, in a larger symphony orchestra. We have to know that there's different aspects to it. The winds, for example, are mainly solo players. So each wind player would just play the one line that is assigned to them. When we talk about the strings, we have section players. So a whole section that could be up to 12, 16 first violins, they would all be playing the same line. And so in that sense, there's interplay within the sections, for example, in the strings. They have to kind of find a way to feel the same phrasing, the same color, the same dynamic all together.
Wow.
And so the aspect, for example, of stand partners in the string section is so essential. If you talk to string musicians, they would be very picky about who their stand partner is and if it's easy to blend with them or not. So there is that aspect. And I want to dare say that in the best orchestral music that we have, there's also and always an element of chamber music, because that dialogue and that interplay between the musicians is essential to bringing it together in a cohesive way. And if you look at symphony orchestra concert, you will notice that there are at least as many looks from the players to the conductor than there are between the players, between the first violin and the first cello, on how to attack, you know, a bow, between the first oboe and the concertmaster.
I don't want to go too far down in the weeds with this, but you said something in the beginning of your reply there that's really fascinating to me and maybe to the listener, and that is that, let's say, eight violinists have to find a common sound. that blends well, that must be difficult to achieve. I mean, everybody is an individual and unique, aren't they?
That is one of the challenges of playing in a symphony orchestra. That is absolutely correct. And that is why you can talk about orchestras that have a specific sound, like the Philadelphia Orchestra under Ormandy. It was called the Ormandy sound. Usually it's something that is built through time with the conductor in between musicians who find that, you know, the ability to be on that same wavelength in the different pieces, in the different styles. And when you witness great performances by really amazing orchestras, something very easy to notice for a listener, for a viewer, is notice which part of the bow the violin sections start at. If you look at the most amazing orchestras in the world, you will see that they exactly attack the sound at exactly the same spot in their bow. So they become a unity in a very magical way, in a way.
Something to add on to that, Marcello, the idea of great orchestras and how they're attacking with the bow from the same place. You can also see, Tom, how the section breathes together. And they move together, and it looks like a dance when they're really unified in that one voice between the sections. It's a beautiful thing to watch. My husband and I watch the Berlin Philharmonic on their streaming service a lot, and that orchestra is just such an amazing group. And if you watch them, you just see them moving together, and it just shows such a cohesiveness in what you hear, because they're feeling it in their bodies in the same way.
Casey, I've heard it said that chamber music is, of course, more intimate and more conversational. What does that mean?
Well, so in chamber music, you have, for instance, a string quartet, and so there's a solo voice on each part. And so the musicians are having a conversation. It's more of a dialogue rather than the big group coming together to create one voice. You have one voice in the first violin part and one voice in the cello. And so the first violin will say something and the cello will answer, and then the viola will come in and the second violin will harmonize with the first violin, or it becomes a conversation between the four players in a way that can be very playful, or they can be playing together. And because there are fewer people involved, each voice can take on a more specific character that becomes more of a dialogue, I think.
With a genre like, let's say, jazz, that would happen literally improvisationally, without any music in front of anybody. That's not the case with chamber music, correct?
Not usually. It's along the same lines that we were speaking of earlier, that they would be following a score for, as Marcello said, a Beethoven string quartet. It is written and strict there. The interpretation is where it becomes improvisatory, but it's within boundaries of what the composer has on the page. But, you know, with tempi or with your feeling of how you want to present the character of the music is where you get the personal voice.
Marcello?
And if I can tag along what Casey said perfectly about the conversational aspect, it's important to remember that it is written in the music. So the way Beethoven would write for a string quartet would emphasize that aspect. We cannot compare the string section of a Beethoven symphony with the way he writes in a string quartet, exactly because when he's writing for those four players, he's having, you know, an intimate setting, like a conversation at the dinner table, as opposed that when he's writing for an orchestra, he's painting a big fresco with large crowds. And the composer himself is already putting that element so much present in there, in the way he writes for the instruments, that it has to be a dialogue, an intimate conversation in a Beethoven string quartet. It's written like that. The exchange between the instruments, their interplay is already written in the music.
I'd like to ask each of you to give us a little bit of background. Perhaps you can help each other with this on how and why it was decided to fold the Lexington Chamber Orchestra into the Chamber Music Festival organization.
The Lexington Chamber Orchestra was started in 2015 by a conductor who was living in Lexington, Jan Pallant. And he gathered friends and colleagues to play this chamber orchestra music because it's a genre that was not really being played a lot in Lexington. You know, the Lexington Philharmonic plays large-scale works, as does the University of Kentucky Symphony Orchestra. And they have large groups that play big symphonies, and they have winds, and they have strings, and they have brass and percussion, and all of the pieces. But there is a whole genre of smaller chamber works for ensembles that just weren't being performed in Lexington. And so they had good success. The group was made up of community musicians who play at a very high level. Many of them are members of LPO or educators, music educators in the community, who have decided to make Lexington their home and are playing all different kinds of music around town. But there was a need for this kind of orchestra, and that's what LCO was started for. As with any arts organization, it takes a lot of money to keep these things running. And there were some financial struggles that the organization was having, and the Chamber Music Festival of Lexington, which was founded in 2007 and has a great presence within the community, they have some stability financially, and it was in their interest to take on LCO because it allowed the Chamber Music Festival to have a year-round presence rather than just presenting concerts at the end of summer, early fall. And many of the musicians were, you know, audience members or colleagues of some of our core musicians who are in the Chamber Music Festival. And so it just made sense to partner with the group because their values of offering high-quality music to our community were perfectly aligned. And so that happened in the fall of 2019, and Chamber Music Festival of Lexington produced a concert for LCO in February of 2020, and then we all know what happened in March. Mm-hmm. And so the getting LCO back up on its feet post-COVID, we're ready to go. We have our new music director with Marcello, and we're excited. We have a lot of the original musicians who performed in the group pre-COVID who are coming back, and they're excited to be making music again. And Chamber Music Festival of Lexington feels really happy to be able to support the revival of this vibrant group.
Marcello, you want to add to that?
I think Casey covered it perfectly. I just wanted to mention an aspect. She talked briefly about the need to have this specific repertoire performed in our community. And it's important to understand because we have started with chamber music. We have compared it with large symphonic music. We haven't really talked about what a chamber orchestra is, which is this entity, which is exactly in between. And again, in that mention that I made about a conductor, you would think of a chamber orchestra as the kind of ensemble that can function with or without. And it's very interesting. The most famous example in our country is the Orpheus Chamber Orchestra. They are an amazing group based in New York. And they made the news when they were founded because they were probably one of the first orchestras to perform without a conductor. So I don't want to get too much into the aspects of if and how much a conductor is needed or not. Probably I'm not the best person to talk about that. But that is the very interesting aspect of it. So we're talking about a larger group of musicians. But historically, what we call a chamber orchestra today is what an orchestra was as it started in the Renaissance, in the classical period, in the 17th, 18th century. Orchestras were the size of our chamber orchestras.
I see.
Then they started becoming bigger, and so we have full symphonic orchestras. But that repertoire is so rich, and there is so much, and there's nobody performing it in Lexington.
Well, Marcello, you wear another hat, a very important another hat, as director of the Central Kentucky Youth Orchestra. So you are witnessing and experiencing the future. What do you see? What does it look like?
Well, first of all, it's a joy, and it's very exciting, is what makes my job an incredible and unique experience, because I work with these young, talented musicians that we have in town, and we have many, and probably people don't know how much talent there is here. We are a very large organization. We serve between 400 and 500 students from 15 counties. We have four symphonic ensembles, two jazz orchestras, two community programs. So we cover basically every aspect of the music education and the musical growth of a young musician. And seeing them grow musically and getting to the point where some of them will decide to take this on as their life and their career, it's really an incredible journey. And what I see is that many of these young musicians will go on to great conservatories and great music schools. Many of them will go on to stay here in Lexington, but still perform at a very high level professionally. And there's so many of them that go from my orchestras into the UK Symphony Orchestra. And then some of them will end up at the Lexington Philharmonic. So I see under my eyes this journey take place. And I cannot but say that the future is exciting and is full of promises.
Well, for both of you, a question about what's happening today, about current trends, about innovation even, that's happening in the music. Is there anything that comes to mind that's really important?
I think something that a lot of music organizations are trying to shift a bit is including music outside of the standard canon of Bach, Beethoven, and Brahms, the three Bs, or, you know, the really traditional Mozart, or just that standard repertoire. People are trying to broaden their programming to include people of color and female composers. And I think a lot of organizations have really made that something that they're trying to do more frequently, which I think in a lot of ways has broadened the audience, because it's not just one thing that we're doing. We're playing that music with great passion and love, the things that the classical music genre has always played, and we're continuing that. And we're enriching it with new music as well. For instance, at the Metropolitan Opera this past year, their ticket sales have been best for their new works that they're producing, even greater than the standards like Traviata or Bohème. Terence Blanchard's opera Champion is happening right now, and it's had great sales and press because it's really exciting the audiences to get out and get back into the theater. There was a little slump after COVID that people, you know, weren't necessarily flocking back into the concert halls. And I think with kind of changing up the programming a bit, it's helping excite people who can come hear the new things and then also the standards that just make us feel all warm and fuzzy inside.
Well, you have a concert coming up, the Lexington Chamber Orchestra does. And listener, if you're hearing us on Sunday evening in our rebroadcast, this will have happened last night, Saturday night. But for those listening to us before Saturday, May 13th, could you all give us the details?
We're excited. This is the revival of the Lexington Chamber Orchestra. It's the first concert after the pandemic, and it's going to happen on Saturday, May 13th at 7:30 at Centenary United Methodist Church in Lexington on Tate's Creek. It's going to be a great program of music for string chamber orchestra that covers basically almost all the ages of the evolution of this type of ensemble. And we start with a piece by Mozart, a wonderful divertimento, and then we go into the Romantic period with Grieg, and then we'll have pieces that are closer to us, a Concerto Grosso by Vaughan Williams, and then a very interesting piece called Five Miniatures for String Orchestra by a Greek-American composer, Andreas Makris.
Will there be an admission?
There's no admission.
It's free.
It's free. We're offering this for free.
Chamber Music Festival of Lexington director Casey Nardolillo and Marcello Cormio, director of the Central Kentucky Youth Orchestra, and now the Lexington Chamber Orchestra as well. Thank you both for joining us.
My pleasure.
Thank you so much for having us.
A tribute to the great Aretha Franklin is on the agenda for Lexville's new season. Next week, we're joined by the new Lexville music director, Malise Brunet. We'll get the details of her first season of programming, as well as her role in a forthcoming Netflix documentary. And we'll hear about the world premiere of Two Black Churches by composer-in-residence, Grammy-nominated, Lexington-born, Sean Opibolo, the piece to be performed by acclaimed baritone Will Liverman. Coming up after the break, pain has its many manifestations. We look at three of them: physical, psychological, emotional. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
This is Brian Burkhart with coming events from Kentucky Humanities. On Monday, May 15th, the Kentucky Authors Book Club will host Kentucky Reads, the book The Woman's Daughter. It's a discussion at Good Foods Co-op in Lexington. The program will begin at 10 a.m. On Tuesday, May 16th, Primetime Family Reading will be held at the Johnson County Public Library in Paintsville. The program begins at 5:30. Wednesday, May 17th, Berea College will host Speakers Bureau, Arches, Waterfalls, and Wildflowers of Kentucky, presented by Valerie Askren. The program will be held at the Berea College Alumni Building and will start at 1:30 p.m. Sponsorship for this program comes from Daniel Boone National Forest. For more information on programs and coming events, visit kyhumanities.org. For Kentucky Humanities, I'm Brian Burkhart. We now return to Eastern Standard.
Pain. It sneaks up on us in many ways, the physical kind, of course, but also emotional and psychological. If you find yourself finally admitting that denial no longer works for managing physical pain, you're hardly alone. According to the Centers for Disease Control, that describes about 50 million of us here in the USA. And there is a variety of ways people deal with that. Former WEKU reporter Mary Meehan came across one approach back in 2019, and her report then is as relevant today as it was 4 years ago.
Wearing a crisp white-collared shirt, expertly applied makeup, and a stylish halo of silver hair, Brenda Peterson is the very picture of put together. But since the Lexington woman is also managing a debilitating chronic illness, there's one comment people should avoid.
I have permission from my doctor at Mayo for anybody that says, "But you don't look sick," to punch him in the throat.
Brenda, an ordained minister, hasn't taken a swing at anybody yet, but the joke reflects the frustration of dealing with chronic fatigue and pain. Until she underwent rehabilitation at a unique Mayo clinic, it's a program that could offer hope to Kentuckians using opioids for pain. During her time in the program, she says, she saw others change their lives.
It was like watching resurrection on a daily basis, because these people would come in here bent over, barely walking, a young woman still in her 20s, shuffling like she was 90 years old, and holding her abdomen constantly. And within 3 days, she's straightening up, and in 3 weeks, she's a new person.
Dr. Christopher Sletten leads the Mayo Clinic in Florida. It's based on a treatment model first used in the 70s, but he says over the years, opioids and technology, like nerve blocks and spinal cord stimulators, became the norm. He says his program, stressing exercise, meditation, and moderation, had an image problem.
If you can imagine a 3-week program that asks people to come off their drugs and exercise and sort of manage their stress is much less appealing than somebody that says, I can stick a needle in your back and you'll feel better this afternoon.
He says the recognition of central sensitization syndrome, or CSS, is at the core of the treatment. Basically, he said, when in pain, the body becomes increasingly alerted to sensation. It immediately sends a distress signal to the brain. Over time, the brain becomes sensitive to those messages. And that, he says...
And so it forms sort of a 1-2 punch, a louder message from the body and a more sensitive receiver in the brain.
Brenda's main symptom was fatigue. Until she had a bout of bacterial meningitis, she'd always been a high-energy person. But following her illness, she was tired all the time. There were other troubling symptoms as well.
Lots and lots of weird things, like skin issues all over my whole body, particularly a scalp that I could itch until I make it bleed, and it doesn't go away, doesn't get any better.
Sletten says most of his patients seek help from many other specialists without success. That was the case for Peterson. She was skeptical that the clinic would work for her. For example, she describes herself as a person with a lifelong aversion to exercise. And the first day at the clinic, she did 3 hours in the gym. In the end, she says...
And it is a wonderful experience. It's very intense. It's not for the faint of heart. It has to be lived out.
Brenda wasn't the only one who needed to change. John, her husband, clearly dotes on his wife. He watches her intently as she talks and laughs at all her jokes. And for years, he could do nothing to alleviate her suffering. The first day of Brenda's treatment, he was told that taking care of her was not his job. The words from Sletten were, "You're fired."
I don't have to talk about it anymore. That's not easy. She's not supposed to say anything about how she's feeling. I can't. Did you sleep well? I'm not supposed to ask. Are you feeling any? No, you cannot ask about that.
It's been a journey for both husband and wife. She dutifully, mostly, does the exercises as required. She practices using her new tools to keep symptoms in control. If she wakes up with a headache, she drinks a glass of water instead of reaching for the Tylenol. If the water doesn't work, she does some stretches and takes a walk. They share a safe word for when she's having a bad day and may need some space.
And mine is Lady Godiva, because Godiva chocolates can cure most any bad day.
Sletten says he likes to stress a simple message.
It's not mind or body, it's mind and body. You can't have an emotional response without some sort of physical consequence and vice versa. And so the dichotomization of saying, well, if I can't somehow physically measure this process, then it must be a psychological malady is really old school thinking. And we now know that even things that are not directly measurable can still have a huge impact on a person's psyche and functioning and lifestyle.
A reprise of her 2019 report on pain management from former WEKU reporter Mary Meehan. Now a source of pain and anguish for many millions of American citizens, and its portrayal by the seasoned actor who is Bill McCann's guest for his series on theater production in Kentucky.
A theater graduate of the University of Kentucky, Deborah Falk has performed on stage, screen, and television, both here in Kentucky and Los Angeles, California. Additionally, she has been a stand-up comic for more than 20 years. But most recently, while continuing her stand-up comedy career, Deborah Falk has been entertaining and educating people across the state as Nancy Green in the one-person play, Being Aunt Jemima, the Pancake Queen. for Kentucky Humanities Chautauqua program. Our discussion will focus on how an actor creates a character, and in this case, Deborah Falk had to create at least two characters for being Aunt Jemima the Pancake Queen. Welcome to Eastern Standard, Deborah Falk.
Why, thank you so much, Mr. Bill McCann.
Unlike many of the Chautauqua characters whose scripts are written by the actor-presenter, the script for Nancy Green, being Aunt Jemima the Pancake Queen, was written by Lexington playwright Beau List. So how did you become involved with the show? Did you audition?
Well, Beau List was my former theater professor there at UK. And so when Beau was thinking up some new things to write about, he thought about me. I had just returned from Hollywood, California, here with my father. So he invited me to read the script. And at first, I wasn't all the way in, but after reading more and doing more research, I was totally into it and grateful that one of my former professors thought about me.
Well, Beau List is white, you're black. Did he get the story right? Or did you need to bring him around to your point of view on one or more aspects of that story?
Well, it wasn't my point of view. What we did was make certain that we could get as many facts as we could. Because Miss Green was born into slavery, the physical proof was limited. So we did work with the Mount Sterling Historical Society. So it wasn't about, I wanted to make certain that we did represent history in its true light, but I also wanted to make certain that I honored and paid homage to Nancy Green.
Now, Kentucky Humanities employs experts in a wide variety of fields, historians, hair, makeup, costumers to bring characters to life. What role did you have in selecting those individuals?
Oh, my goodness. Now, that was the most exciting part. You know, I've been doing stand-up comedy for over a quarter of a century, so I'm used to producing my own shows and entities, the music, the lighting, stage production, picking the venue. So I had total control over who I selected. I chose Dr. Alistine Turley, who at that time was the director of African American Studies at Berea College. I went with a renowned professional librarian that works at the Carol Little Library there at UK, Mrs. Raynette Jones. She was instrumental in my research. I also work with Mrs. Rosetta Quisenberry, who wrote the book, The Sagas. I went to church with Miss Quisenberry. I knew all of these mature, older, educated black women, and it was their opinion and their expertise that I was reaching for.
I've been an actor myself, so I know that creating a character is a challenge. In this case, it seems to me you were creating and bringing to life two distinct characters, Aunt Jemima and Nancy Green. So who were these women?
Aunt Jemima is a stereotype. There is no real Aunt Jemima. That was a name that was meant to be derogatory to Negro women, black women, African-American women. And so when we start thinking about stereotypes, where did Aunt Jemima came from? It came from the minstrel shows, which was actually white men dressed up in blackface as if that's how we all looked or something. So I had to differentiate the character of the minstrel shows as opposed to who Mrs. Nancy Green truly was, which was a philanthropist, an educator, a nurse, a mother. And it's the same thing a lot of us go through because we wear the mask. So we act a certain way at church. We act a certain way at work when we're around our colleagues, and then we act a different way when we're with our families and our loved ones, or if we're out playing kickball. So for me, I had to make certain that people could understand there was a difference between the messy minstrel character of Aunt Jemima and the loving, devoted mother and preacher and educated that Miss Nancy Green is.
Can you tell us a little bit about Nancy Green?
Well, she was born into slavery in Montgomery County in Mount Sterling, Kentucky. After she was with the family for so long, they ended up moving to Covington and then traveled to Chicago from there. So they started out in Chicago right after the Great Fire back in 1872. So she had been with them just as the city started to rebuild and raise their boys. So she basically, once she left Kentucky, she settled in Chicago, which is where she started the church, Olivet Baptist Church. I did go to do my research to see the original church, which was a small house that had been transformed over to the big church, and they're now remodeling. I also visited the grave where she's buried at Oakwood Cemetery in Chicago so that I could truly feel her beginnings at Somerset Creek in Mount Sterling, to the streets of Montgomery County, to the auction block where she may have seen some things happen. I truly had to immerse myself into her and the time that everything was happening before the Civil War and after. So I just wanted to make certain that I honor her.
Did you have a sense of who she was and how she got the job representing Aunt Jemima and how she interacted with that position? Did she enjoy it? Or, you know, it seems to me that it would be very difficult, having gotten out of slavery,
sure,
to pretend to be a slave again. What did you find out about her personality and how she was dealing with this issue?
Well, what I found out about her personality was the same things that were presented to me. This woman had just been freed from slavery and then asked to portray a slave. When I was in my MFA program, the only roles that I was given was a crackhead or a prostitute. So I'm like, we're in an MFA program, people. And I said, absolutely not. And they just went on to find another one, we'll say, to be polite. So when we start talking about who she was, once I began to learn who she was, I began to learn who I was. As I said, this was a woman that raised these young men, so I know she could read if she raised doctors, judges, lawyers, attorneys. That's what these young Walker men were. So for her to be able to not have her own children and to be able to nurture someone else's children that wasn't related, that didn't look anything like her, I too am faced with these issues. If I'm teaching in a program, who do I help? Do I help someone that looks like me? Do I help someone that I know needs the help? Or do I help someone else because it'll better my career? I believe that I know who Nancy Green is because I know who I am. She dedicated her service. So the monies that she used, she helped Negroes who couldn't get loans. And she also built the churches and did traveling ministries.
I know that several performances of Aunt Jemima are scheduled during June, in the days leading up to and surrounding Juneteenth. For listeners who might have an interest in being Aunt Jemima, having it come to their community, how do they connect with you? How do they schedule a visit by you? Or for that matter, any of the other Chautauqua characters?
They can go to KentuckyHumanities.org, click on Programs, click on Chautauquas, and you scroll down, and you can select, and there'll be a booking form there, and you pick your dates. Our emails and our phone numbers are listed. So people, you know, I put my Google number out there as public. I don't mind anyone having my Google number, which is area code 85995516282. And then we list our emails and you let us know, hey, I'd like for you to perform in February for Black History Month, or I'd love for you to perform in June for Juneteenth. What I would love to encourage people to do is to please hire us throughout the year. You know, a lot of the other performers may have other jobs, so they'll work with you in scheduling. And you can do that by speaking with the Chautauquan personally.
Okay. I've been speaking with Deborah Falk, the actress who portrays Nancy Green in the one-person Kentucky Humanities play, Being Aunt Jemima, the Pancake Queen. for Kentucky Chautauqua. Thank you for being here today.
Thank you so much.
And then there is pain of the emotional sort, detailed in an eavesdropping sort of way, in the latest from Tom Eblen's guest, Kentucky author Hannah Pittard.
As a professor of English, Hannah Pittard teaches creative writing at the University of Kentucky, but she is better known as the author of four award-winning novels that have been recommended by such publications as the New York Times, the Washington Post, and Oprah Magazine. She has just published a new book titled We Are Too Many, a memoir, kind of. The headline for this memoir is what happened when Pittard found out her husband, who is also a writer, was having an affair with her best friend. The jacket copy quite accurately describes the book as clever and bold and radically honest to an unthinkable degree. It is all of that and much more. This book is an experimental, highly readable, and beautifully written meditation on love, sex, marriage, embarrassment, and self-doubt. But in the end, it is a book about personal growth and acquired wisdom. And once you start reading it, it's very hard to put down. Here to talk with us about her memoir, We Are Too Many, is Hannah Pittard. Hannah, welcome to Eastern Standard.
Thanks for having me.
So describe the book for us.
It is, as you say, it's a book in part about the aftermath of my divorce. And it's also about the 10 years leading up to it, including the marriage, including the very long friendship that preceded the marriage, two friendships, really, the friendship with my ex-husband and the friendship with my former best friend. But it's also about, it's about my childhood. It's about the bad decisions I made and eating disorders. I mean, it's a whole bunch of fun stuff in there.
Yeah. Well, was the process of writing it really good therapy for you?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it was accidentally. So that was not my intention. As I say in the introduction, the book was born out of an essay that I wrote for Adam Ross many, many years ago. He happened to call me right after he'd taken over the Swanee Review, and it was completely flattered by this phone call. I didn't know him. I knew his books. So I was very excited that he had reached out to me. And he was reaching out to ask me to write a short story for the Swanee Review. And as it so happened, I had just gotten back from New York. I had just seen my lawyer. I had just found out about my husband at the time, his affair with my best friend. And so I think it took 5 minutes for our phone call to shift from fiction to me spilling my guts to this man I'd never met. And but, you know, he has he's written Mr. Peanut is an intimate look at a complicated marriage, to say the least. And so we started talking about his book, my book. And by the end of our 3 or 4 hour phone call, he had talked me into writing an essay. And I was not a nonfiction writer by trade or by instinct. And I worked for maybe 6, 7, 8 months on that essay, which is longer than I've spent on some of the novels I've written. Mm-hmm. And it went through many, many drafts. And Adam was a great therapist and editor. And there were a lot of things that I put in the early drafts. And he would say, I'm really glad you got that out of your system. Try again. Let's keep going. And so we ended up with, I thought, a really literary essay that told a certain side, a certain aspect of the story. And after the essay came out, about a year later, I was promoting a different book and I'd show up at readings and people wanted to talk to me about the essay. They didn't want to talk to me about the novel I'd written. And they kept asking me for the details. You know, they were asking for the things that Adam told me not to include. Mm-hmm. And the more people asked and the more I got used to telling the story, I finally one day sat down. It was actually 2020 and everyone was sitting down and staying inside. And there was nothing else to do. And kind of on a lark, I started trying to tell the story.
Mm-hmm. But you realized there was a good book there.
Yeah, I did. At first, it was very much about, and this goes back to your question, was it therapeutic or helpful to write it? At first, it was about getting the noise out of my head. I think there was a lot of noise in people's heads in early 2020, isolation in ways that none of us were expecting. And there were these conversations that were playing again and again and again in my head. And I'm already an obsessive person, and I'm already somebody who, because of my love of language and my love of words, I'll try to remember as much as I can about the things I overheard, the things I said myself in a day, last week, last year. And that particular kind of loneliness and unexpected isolation made certain conversations louder. And they happened to be the conversations that were with my ex-husband, with my former best friend, and I started wanting to try to put together the narrative that got us where we were, that got us to that divorce in such an unceremonious manner.
Well, so many of the names in the book are changed, but have the people you written about read the book yet?
I don't know if they've read the book. I don't know yet. I don't know if they will, you know. I do know that my ex-husband's got a novel coming out. I don't know when. I've heard from people that it's 2024, maybe. And a question that I ask myself from time to time when I think of it, when it pops up in my head, is, am I going to read it? You know, it has a premise not dissimilar from my memoir, so I've been told. And so I'm curious, will I read it? Will I not read it? I don't know if they'll read my book or not. My family has read the book, though, and everyone in my family, they've had their names, not, you know who they are. There's my mother, there's my brother. My sister gets a name because she was such a pivotal part of the story that I'm telling, and everyone who matters has read it and they've signed off on it, which is good.
Yeah.
That's good.
That is good. That is good. One of the things that's very interesting about the book is the structure. It's like a series of short conversations and then kind of longer conversations. Tell me a little about how you kind of came up with that structure, because it's very effective and, I mean, you know, a great dialogue writer.
Oh, thank you. I love dialogue. You know, my ex-husband used to tell me that I was only ever 50% present, especially when we were out in public, and I never denied it because I love eavesdropping. I love listening to what people say and how they say it. So thank you. I appreciate that. But the book is told in three parts, and the first one is almost play-like in its dialogue. And those are the sort of noisy conversations that I say I had playing over and over on repeat in my head, and they span about a decade. And I didn't intend to not write the entire book like that, but there was a day where I realized I'd written all the conversations down that I cared to write down, the ones that meant the most, even if they seemed to have just a tiny little nugget of interest, the ones that kept coming back. I'd done it. I'd written them. And then there was another day where I reread those conversations that I'd written, and I hadn't even finished reading them, and I realized, okay, that's long enough. That's enough of those conversations. And at that point, I realized I could only ask the reader to immerse themselves in those conversations for so long. And it became about distilling, picking the best ones, picking the ones with the right thematic tensions and narrative arcs. And then part two, which is an imagined conversation between my ex-husband, as I imagine him to be now, and me, as I claim to be now, that happened, again, early in the pandemic, and I was upstairs alone in my office in the attic, and I wrote it in a single sitting, the first draft in a single sitting, and I wanted to attempt to give him a voice, attempt to provide him a platform to respond to the conversations that I claim happened in part one, and to kind of take me to task. I thought that was necessary to take me to task in part two. And then in part three, it was like getting the noise out of the data. By the time I got to part three, I was comfortable actually using the first person pronoun and taking away the performance of the style of parts one and two and just saying plainly, this is what happened. Here are the anecdotes that have informed my bad decision-making abilities. Here's how I got here in my words. And I never intended to have three parts. I never intended it to happen in this manner. But ultimately, I think the process of winnowing down from many voices to two voices to just that one voice, it was necessary to get to me being comfortable to tell my story in first person as nonfiction.
Yeah.
For the first time, really in detail, not as an essay, not as a literary essay, but in detail. I wasn't prepared to do it without getting through steps one and steps two. And by the time I'd written part three, I realized it couldn't exist without one and two. Like the process is right. Part of the story.
Well, it does kind of help bring it all together.
Yeah, I think so.
And one of the things I think toward the end of the book, too, you talk about what you learned. And one observation I thought was really interesting, it says that you learned how to keep only the least important secrets. What does that mean to you?
Well, I think if people are telling the truth, everybody's lying, right? Everybody's keeping secrets. And I think it's also probably pretty healthy to have secrets. And at least for me, it is. I need to know that there are things that are mine and mine alone. You know, I'm in a committed relationship. I think it's a healthy relationship. And I think part of what is healthy about it is that he knows that he's getting 88%. 82% of me, and that's good enough. And what he also knows is that if I am lying or keeping secrets, it's not about stuff that can hurt him or hurt me.
Yeah,
it's little things like I bought an extra plant, and maybe it's hanging out in my office. And then one day he'll say, "When did you get that plant?" And I'll say, "It's always been there."
Right,
and he'll look, and you know, it keeps it interesting.
Yeah. Once again, the book is We Are Too Many, a Memoir, Kind of, by Hannah Pittard and published by Henry Holt and Company of New York. Hannah, thanks for being with us today.
No, thanks for having me.
For WEKU's Eastern Standard, this is Tom Eblin with the Carnegie Center for Literacy and Learning.
Thanks for joining us. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions. Mike Savage, executive producer, Neil Kesterson, sound designer and technical director, Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog. We're online at esweku.org, where you can check out the Eastern Standard Archive, our series, our partners, and more, and sign up for our weekly e-newsletter. You can find Eastern Standard on the WEKU app, on NPR One, and anywhere you get podcasts, including Apple and Spotify. Want to call something to our attention or suggest a topic? Our email is es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.